speak about Islam, so let's begin there. Glenn, what do you think about the idea of recognizing Islam as a organized crime syndicate?
Well, that's very important. I do want to address that, especially on a news item related to that. But first, mm-hmm. I can only really hit and run today, so I want to address something more important first.
Okay, sure.
And looking at the trenchant news stories of the day, I do not find it the least bit surprising that inadequacy should be found with the balls of the NFL. I mean, the way they're caving to political agendas left and right, mostly left, it's not surprising that would divert their resources, you know, and that they would find deficiencies with their balls.
It's true that the NFL has shown a lack of manliness as it relates to standing up to issues. So I'm with you there. We have to be pretty careful here because we don't want to become crude, but I know the innuendo on Deflategate is pretty extraordinary. I do have to say that and yesterday, of course, I devoted a segment to Bill Belichick's response, and I thought Bill Belichick's response was really well timed. I wish he had done it a day earlier, but you know he went into great detail. He made a 7.5, 8.5 minute, I think it was 8.5 minute statement about his whole philosophy on the condition of footballs, and made it just absolutely ironclad. I have never discussed it, never had any discussion with anyone at any time about the inflation of the football. And laid it all on the line and said, this is my philosophy and this is what I have done. And then I compare that to Tom Brady, which I think was tragic. And, you know, I happen I'm a football fan. I admire Tom Brady's skill. I actually have come to like him as an individual. I mean, I only know him because of his football prowess. But the fact of the matter is, I thought Tom Brady did a absolutely horrible job, and that he was not credible, and I think that Belichick was credible, and this whole thing is what should have been a minor indiscretion is now a major issue, and it is it's having another very negative effect on the credibility of the National Football League.
Yeah, well, you know, Belichick was a day late and a few PSI short. Grown men chasing rubber bladders covered with big things over there, you want to make sure they're nice and firm and working right.
But actually,
it's sort of a commentary on discipline in the society. I mean, somebody's got the assignment of checking out the equipment before a game, and obviously somebody wasn't doing their job. It was that simple.
Scott's point of view is that the Deflategate scandal, the failure really is, no matter how it's played out, the failure's with the league. It's that most quarterbacks want the ball a certain way. The equipment manager is going to try to please the quarterback. That is their job. They try to please everybody in the team to give them what they want. They're going to give the quarterback what they want in terms of the condition of the balls. It's the league's responsibility to monitor their rules. And I'm convinced that Tom Brady won the balls at a certain inflation. The equipment manager did that. That there's other quarterbacks that are also trying to do the same thing, and that the NFL is not monitoring its own rules, and that they are having their credibility deflated once again.
Well, when the visiting team's kicker, I would think if the one who'd have a dog in this fight would be the visiting team's kicker. Because,
well, actually, it's a different set of balls.
Oh, so balls. Okay. Well, the kickers. Okay, so
the kickers get to choose. The kickers get to choose their own set of balls, and the kicking balls and the game balls that are used in scrimmage plays are different balls.
Very good.
They're not all playing with the same balls.
Right, and you know, because when you're kicking balls, you want to make sure you got the right one. The other thing I wanted to bring up was this hostage situation with the Muslims and the Japanese, and they having to decide. You know, I hate to be in his position, but you know, it seems to me they can't give into a $200 million extortion, you know, kidnapping thing, ransom thing. I would love to see, okay, fine, you kill these people, And I know this isn't your tack, but part of me would like to see a fuel air bomb dropped on some camp. You know, find their location. When they kill them, drop a fuel air bomb, that, you know, on there that consumes everything and for a 200-yard radius or something.
Yeah, I'm not, not my view on it. My view on it is that, first of all, kidnapping for ransom is standard Islamic behavior. And I don't know why the two Japanese individuals were there, but they obviously were ignorant of Islam to be in a position either in Iraq or Syria to be kidnapped. Shame on them. There's a consequence of being ignorant on something as deadly and as vicious as Islam. Let the Muslims do what they're going to do. You can't capitulate to them, but the Japanese should not have had individuals there. The Japanese shouldn't be at war with the Islamic State. We should just all ignore them. Stop doing business with them and ignore them.
Okay, for now, for those who insist that Islam is either a force for good or I want to be one of the great religions, or at very least benign, okay, then why aren't there Muslim clerics, imams, and mullahs standing up the world over, decrying this violence, saying, policing their own ranks and saying this is horrific and wrong.
Yeah.
If somebody characterizing themselves as Roman Catholic tried to pull this off, the Pope would be on TV decrying it, along with every Monsignor and Cardinal Bishop they could find.
Well, one of the differences is that Roman Catholicism, for all of its faults, is organized. There is a hierarchy, and there is an organization. There is even an organization within Orthodox Christianity. There is no organization within Islam. There's none. There is absolutely no agreement in Islamic schools. There's no agreement in Islam. And Islam stands divided at somewhere between 80-20 and 70-30 between Sunnis and Shias, and they don't get along at all. Then you have another issue with Islam where the Muslim clerics universally know what the ninth surah of the Quran says, which is that all Muslims must be jihadists or they become hypocrites, and a hypocrite ceases to be a Muslim and they must be killed. So there is no Muslim cleric in the world that's unaware of that. And therefore, they know that if they speak out against Islamic terrorism, Islamic beheadings, then what they do is they put themselves in harm's way unless they're also able at the same time to convey good Muslims, jihadist Muslims, hey, listen, I'm doing this under taqiyya, I'm doing this under deception. It's more effective for us to work this way in the West.
Right.
And there are some imams in the West that are speaking out against, for example, what Boko Haram is doing in terms of, and the Islamic State in terms of raping thousands of little girls. But it's a very small number. It's only in the West, and it's only as part of the taqiyya authorized deception of Islam.
Right. Well, it certainly gives the lie to this notion that it's a great religion. Well, you know, later today, an atheist host on this network is going to make fun of those who say, think that Islam is bad, and they'll say, oh, those bad, oh, they're afraid of those bad Muslims, and so we'll have to hear that. We'll turn around and admit that there's something fundamentally wrong with any ideology that can allow this to happen without a groundswell of opposition from within its own ranks.
This is what I would say, is that those who pretend that Islam is a great religion and are critical of those who expose it and condemn it based upon its founder, based upon its own internal documents, its scriptures, that they are deliberately and knowingly ridding their perspective of all evidence, and that they are being wholly irrational because of their zealous overwhelming adherence to their religion. And their religion is socialist secular humanism, and it's moral code, which is political correctness, that their devotion to their religion has caused them to negate and disregard 100% of the evidence and to be wholly and completely irrational and immoral. And that's the bottom line. If you are defending Islam, you are being wholly and completely ignorant, you're being wholly and completely irrational, and you're being wholly and completely immoral. And the only thing that would cause somebody who is not a Muslim to be completely irrational, immoral, and ignorant, and to state it publicly, is there are so vested into political correctness and humanism and socialism that it is part of their religion, their religious duty to mislead.
Yeah, it's funny because the same people will make fun of other people's faith and claim that they don't believe anything, and think they're the smartest guy in the room.
But the fact is, they are part of the second largest religion in the world. The largest religion in the world is still Christianity. 1.2 million Roman Catholics, about 500 million Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox Christians, and about 300 to 400 million Protestant Christians. Christianity is by far the most popular religion in the world, although it's losing ground rapidly. And the second largest religion in the world is the religion of man, humanism. And its primary moral code is political correctness, which is to be incorrect about everything. And the third largest religion, of course, is Islam, with about 1.4 to 1.5 adherents, most of whom are fundamentalists. So the second largest religion in the world claims to be unreligious, that they don't believe in anything. And the fact is, what they have been indoctrinated to believe is
right. Well, it's certainly ideological. Are you there? Hello? Hello?
Yeah, welcome back to Shattering This. We had a little technical difficulty at the end of the last segment. Both Glenn fell off and our voiceover internet protocol connection also failed, but we've gone back to the old-fashioned technique of using the telephone. I do want to also say that since we have continued to talk about Islam in this segment, that many of you are aware, and many if not most of the listeners to this program are aware, that on Fridays, the Friday at sundown becomes the Shabbat. We do a Shabbat radio program on Blog Talk Radio talking about the Torah. We've very near now completing a very long series on the 119th Psalm that tells us how to properly observe the Torah. And since we do devote an hour and a half on Fridays to the Torah, I feel very comfortable continuing with the news in the second hour here on Shattering Myths, as I say, because it's 7:30 Eastern, 4:30 Pacific time. For those of us who enjoy focusing entirely on the Torah, we have a program on Blog Talk Radio, Yada Yada Radio, specifically designed for that. I don't know if we still have Glenn available, and if we do, Glenn, if you wanted to complete your thought on the realization that those who speak kindly of Islam and who have condemned those who expose and criticize Islam based upon its scriptures and founder, that they are universally speaking out of ignorance, they're irrational, and they are aiding and abetting a crime syndicate, they're immoral. Well, since I don't hear Glenn, I'm going to go through the news. Well, we do have Kirk. Well, if you could patch Kirk in, because my stack certainly is not working.
Can you hear me?
I can. Hi, Kirk.
Yeah, how you doing? Good morning.
Yeah, hi.
I had a couple of questions, but I didn't want to interrupt your train of thought.
No, please. Go ahead.
Okay. There was yesterday, after I came back from work, I listened to the tapes, and I had you were talking about Abraham and Paul going up, and Abraham going up the hill with Yitzhak.
Yes.
You know, in the argument in Christendom, was always, Paul would say, you know, Abraham had his, got his, got saved because he had faith and he went up the hill. And, you know, with Yishak. Now, and the other argument was, as opposed to the followers of law, they would say that he, because he acted and obeyed the command to go up the hill, he was, that saved him.
Yeah, but by the way, did Yahweh at the time say anything about saving Abraham?
About
saving Abraham. Is there any comment from God?
Well, that was
about saving Abraham as a result of him going up the Mount Moriah.
No, and that was the point I was going to make. I said, now, isn't it true that the minute you accepted the covenant, the terms and conditions of the covenant, you're saved. And,
correct.
That has no bearing on it. To what was happening when Abraham went up there, he trusted, in my opinion, he had trusted and relied on Yahweh, and they were working together to tell his story.
He knew Yahweh was going to provide a solution.
Yeah, he's provided everything up to this point.
Well, Yahweh has told him that the covenant is going to be extended through Yishak. And so since Yahweh has fulfilled everything that he has promised, when Abraham was walking up Mount Moriah, he had absolutely no doubt in his mind that Yahweh was going to provide a solution. So, you know, God had asked him to do something. He was following what Yahweh had asked him to do, and he knew for certain that Yahweh would provide a solution. But there is no, what's interesting here is there is absolutely no mention in this discussion of Abraham being saved, because that wasn't the purpose of the event. Yahweh tells us that he attributed to Abraham vindication, tzedakah. When Abraham, he took Abraham, when Abraham said, you know, I don't get this inheritance thing, very early on in their relationship, he said, you know, keep on promising me this wonderful inheritance through the covenant, but I don't have an heir. I'm gonna tell you, yeah, I really don't get it. And so Yahweh took him to heaven. He took him to the light of stars. And he says, I want you to relate to what I'm showing you here. And when Abraham says, oh, now I get it, Yahweh at that point says, I thereby attribute this understanding to your vindication. So Abraham was saved, if you will, the moment he accepted and understood and responded to the conditions of the covenant.
Welcome back to Shatterness. I'm your host, Yahweh. We're having a conversation with Kirk. And Kirk, I think it's pretty profound realization that there is absolutely no mention of Abraham's salvation as part of his willingness to trust Yahweh and to climb Mount Moriah as a dress rehearsal for Passover.
But there's no preacher out there that doesn't use that as an example. I mean, if you listen to enough sermons, as I did for years, I mean, that's their big crux. That's their big, this is why. And to me, it was, Yah likes to teach, and he likes to engage his children to teach with him, participate in it. And him participating in something that's going to happen in 33 CE that Abraham didn't understand because he doesn't know what we know. So he trusted him, and they did it, and that's fine, and it was a wonderful story, but it also was, it was for us. You know, future generations.
Yeah, it's a marvelous presentation because it occurred exactly 40 Yobel, 2,000 years before the fourth century from the time that, fourth millennia, the time that Adam and Chawa were expelled from the garden. It was exactly 4,000 years to the time that Yahusha fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, Bakurim, and Shavuah. But it was exactly 2,000 years or 40 Yobel, that Abraham went through this dress rehearsal, and every aspect of the story was designed to help us understand what was going to happen exactly 40 Yobel later. Same mountain. A man named Merciful Father was leading the procession. A sacrificial lamb was had a crown of thorns, if you will, at the time was provided to spare the life of the young participant in the covenant. They walked 3 days. They're all the way up to the point of climbing the mountain. There were two witnesses. The sacrifice was to of the only son. Was to occur on wood. He would be pierced. I mean, just every nuance of that story, including the place where it took place, Mount Moriah, was specifically designed to be to point us to Yahweh being honorable and trustworthy and doing exactly what he promised he would do, exactly on time, in exactly the same place.
That's a prophetic layer. I mean, calling it prophecy. I mean, they told the whole story ahead of time, and it all came true just about, you know, with so many parallels.
Right, with the focus being on Pesach, Passover. There's a reason Yahweh did not speak of sparing Abraham's life, but did speak of sparing Yishak's life. It didn't even speak of saving Abraham. Nor did he speak of saving Yishak. All he did is spoke of sparing Yishak's life, because all Passover does is spares one's life. It doesn't save anybody. This was a dress rehearsal for Passover, not for Matzah.
Yeah. Let me segue into another question, if I may.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Teaching examples and so forth, and this is the New Testament so-called witnesses story.
Mm-hmm.
It's not found in Matthew, to my knowledge. I think it's found in Yohanan or John. There's a story about Lazarus.
Yes.
Is that a true story? And if it is, why? Because it doesn't teach, you know, preachers also use that as like Jesus, quote, unquote, is used to, you know, like he practiced on him or he did that as a precursor to him raising from the dead. And Yahusha didn't raise from the dead, and he didn't, you know, he didn't put him back in his body. And if I was dead, don't ever pray to ask him to put me back in my body.
Exactly.
Is that a true story?
First of all, we really don't know whether it occurred or not. But the realization is that it was, here's a man who had been dead for, at least presumed to have been dead for a period of a day, 2 days, something in that range. And he went from the physical world to the physical world. He wasn't resurrected from the physical world to the spiritual world. There's no reference whatsoever of Lazarus becoming a spiritual entity.
Yeah.
And so when somebody brings it up, I say, so? I mean, really, what is the difference between taking somebody who has been declared dead and they're not buried in the sense that we think of buried? They were just put in a rock enclosure, a sepulcher, and then open end, you know, kind of thing, laid down on a limestone shelf. Allowing that person to walk out of that and healing somebody whose eyes had atrophied and no longer worked, somebody whose legs atrophied and no longer worked. I mean, what really is the difference? All he was doing is allowing a physical body to work again.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it be the eyes, whether it be hearing, whether it be the legs or the arms or a skin disease. In the case of Lazarus and all these other cases, he was allowing a physical body to operate again. And what did Yahusha tell us about the physical body operating again and why he was willing to do it?
Well, he did it for his sisters and all. They say in the stories about he loved his friend and he did it as. But I don't see.
He explained why he did it. He said, "Listen, resolving a malady in the physical body is no big deal. Y'all should not be so excited about this. This is no big deal. In fact, he was actually bored by it. He was annoyed by it. Even in the Lazarus thing, you can tell he was annoyed by it, the request, because he recognized that resolving a issue in the physical body was meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
And he said so. He said, I only do this because I want you to think. And what I want you to realize is if I can heal a bum legs that, you know, have atrophied, if I can heal an eye that has atrophied, if I can heal a body that has atrophied, then maybe you'll recognize that what I'm here to do is to resolve your soul, which is atrophied. And that is the far more important thing. I mean, he said, I'm doing this so that you understand that I can resolve the issues of your atrophied soul.
Mm-hmm.
And so the purpose of Lazarus, the purpose of all of the physical miracles of healing the body was to show that he could heal the soul.
Yeah. Well, in that context, it totally makes sense to me. I was just having trouble saying, why would you, number one, he didn't show off, and he's,
right.
You know, why would he do that?
Right? He was reluctant to do it. You even notice he was, every time that he's asked to do a miracle like that, he's saying, you know, he's reluctant to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, they had to put the guy down through the ceiling just so he could see him on his bed.
Right. And any time there's an explanation, he says, I'm only doing this because I want you to realize that, you know, if I can do the easy thing, which is to heal the physical body, then I can certainly do the more profound thing, which is to heal the soul.
Yeah, well, that totally makes sense.
So that's really his reason in doing so. And as you and I know, there was no physical resurrection of Yosha's body because it had to be destroyed as the Passover lamb that night. And we recognize that from the eyewitness accounts where no one recognized him. And so all we have on Bukurim, the first day of the week, following the fulfillment of Pesach and Matzah, is the reunification of Yosha's soul after it was released from Sheol and Yahweh's spirit. You know, the Yahweh spirit left him just before the final culmination of Pesach, so the physical body could die as the Passover lamb. So God is gone, and God's set-apart spirit reunifies with Yosha's soul at Bukurim. That is the story that is being told, and it's beautifully told in Psalm 22 and Psalm 88 and Yashaya Isaiah 53.
Mm. Wow. Yeah, that's a better take. I was having trouble with that one, with the Lazarus story. I just couldn't figure out why.
Yeah, you know, what I have come to do, and it's like all things, I think you grow and you evolve the more time you spend with Yahweh and his testimony, is I've come now to reject almost all of the so-called Christian New Testament with very few exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
I think that much of Matthew can be affirmed and validated when you translate the Greek into the Hebrew word that was actually spoken and conveyed at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Matanyah's witness, because it was originally written in Hebrew and translated into Greek, that you can get it back into the Hebrew mindset. And I think that that most of what appears in Matanyah is presented in the right order, with accurate information, and that it's the most trustworthy of the sources. I'm only interested in Luke's account when there's something in Luke that is not covered in Matanyah,
mm-hmm.
and when it is wholly adverse to Christianity, because then you know, it's pretty unlikely they twisted that or that Paul influenced it. The same thing is true in Mark, and there really isn't anything in Mark that I'm aware of that isn't in Matanyah. And then Yahochanan, the problem with Yahochanan's testimony is that, first of all, there's very little biographical narrative. You know, he gets right into post-Bukurim in a hurry. I mean, it's like it's almost like Yohanan, when he was writing his testimony, realized, you know, Matthew did a fine job of detailing the mission, the words and deeds of Yahusha. There's no reason to go over that. I'll cover some of the things that Matanyahu didn't cover, but then I'm going to spend all of my time talking about what happened after Bakurim, between Bakurim and Shavua. And that's where most of Yohanan's testimony is. And the problem with it is that since it was so popular, it was the most heavily copy-edited. Yeah, so you really have all sorts of things in it that you know were not said and that are inaccurate. And so that's a challenge. And then, you know, there's many aspects of Revelation which I think are useful, but I think it's only understood when the perspective is Daniel.
Right.
We'll be back. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. In addition now to Kirk, we have Larry on the line. And Kirk, I think there's a common denominator in the point that you are making as to what is it that we can trust and how do we understand it. And Larry's most controversial position, one that I share, which is that we ought not to be all that worried about what we eat. And being Tory observant, you know, there's a line that I also had a thought that probably Yahusha didn't say, and now I realize he did say it, which is, you know, when he sends people out, you know, eat whatever's put in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, my initial thought was, well, that's contradictory to the Torah, which says these things are good for you, these things are not good for you, but. Tonight, when we do our Shabbat program, I mean, I want to focus on the Devarim passage, which says, Yahweh, you're very clearly saying, I'm making an exception here. I don't want you to be fixated on food. I want you to eat whatever you want to eat. I'm going to tell you what's good for you and what's not good for you. That doesn't change. But when it comes to eating, you can eat whatever you want. So, Larry, did you know that that there is a Torah passage? It's in the 12th chapter of Devarim that says that Yahweh is making one exception relative to the instructions that he has provided, and it's you can eat whatever you want so long as you're thoughtful about it.
Yeah, which would mean not taking part in the Easter ham. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Now the Easter ham, thing makes perfect sense because the people that are eating the Easter ham are not being thoughtful about it. You're right.
Right. That's right. You know, I completely understand that, but no, I didn't know that was in Devarim. It's amazing, isn't it? All that fight and all that attack. You know, you seem to get that from people who think that Yahweh is a religious deity laying out religious, quote,
laws.
Edicts.
Right.
Edicts he's laying out. He's
that you have to behave and you have to follow, you have to keep, and God's saying, you know, listen, every bit of the instruction I gave you is beneficial. Now, I'm going to give you one exception on what you should do. And he goes right through and he says, you know, it's dealing with food that is not clean. I'm making an exception here. So long as you're thoughtful, so long as you understand who I am and what we're doing together, I'm going to make an exception on the food. And he lays it out beautifully. And that's what I thought we'd focus on tonight before we return to the 119th Psalm.
I enjoy that. There is something I want to bring up here that's kind of off subject, if it's okay.
Go ahead.
You did some amazing work in the last days section of Yada Yah.
Oh, thank you.
And that was tedious work that you got into there.
Trying to detail why God was so adverse to Babylon and Persia and Alexander the Great, as well as to Rome, and how all of his statements.
Alexander, and
right?
That's what I want to get into here.
Yeah, I had no idea that Alexander was as bad as he was.
Yeah. Absolutely stunning. The Waha Shabar.
Yeah.
But describing the exact way that he would die. die.
Yeah, I thought that was just amazing. The bursting of the cells.
I want to throw some kudos your way. I did a couple of notes on this now and have put them out there, and people are just blown away.
Yeah.
My favorite part
of translating Yahweh's testimony is that, and it's the thing that I'm accused of a lot, is, you know, why don't you just provide the translations and translate the entire books and just spend less time with the explanations and the research. And I'm not capable of doing that because
a lifetime.
First of all, it would take a lifetime. But second of all, the fun part is doing the research. You know, the fun part is here's Yahweh telling us how this bum named Alexander was going to die, and then you do the research, and he died exactly that way.
Membranes rupturing.
Oh yes.
Find out that's exactly what happened to him.
Yeah.
I am absolutely. It's stunning.
It's
wild today. Just to tell you that work was amazing, and people's eyes are kind of opening very wide to looking at that.
Yes. You know, but I want to tell you the thing that really grabbed me, and I know Kirk, you've also read this last day's review, and they're really long chapters because there's so much history to go over. But the thing that really struck me was trying to understand the mindset of Rome and Greece that enabled Christianity to grow out of myth and paganism. That was the part that really struck me as I, for the first time, I came to understand how it was possible to promote Christianity and why it prevailed. It's not a good story. It's a hideous story. But at least I understood for the first time.